colleagues from the legislature are in session, as they are paid to do. So rather than keep people waiting, I'd like to get the meeting underway. Let me take a look at if everybody can grab a seat. I'm trying to think whether or not has everybody been here at least one meeting? I don't need to do introductions. I think we're good for the day. So let me say hello and welcome back. It's been a while, but we have some good work to do today, and I think it's, for me, it's very exciting to move forward into implementation steps, and the beginning of that is really to look at how will we know whether or not we've made progress and looking at metrics. So that's going to be the majority of our meeting today, but I do want to make sure we approve the January minutes. If you remember correctly, there were minutes that were distributed that had a number of errors. And Jeannie wasn't at that meeting, and so they've been corrected. So I wonder if I could ask for a motion for approval of the minutes from January 20th, please. Thank you. In a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor? Any opposed? The minutes are approved as issued. So with that, I think today we actually have some really interesting going forward steps to look at, which is the metrics for our accountability and monitoring process for the plan. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dennis to lead us in that discussion, please. So welcome back. And it's not snowing, and it's nice outside.
Dennis, are you going to take questions or concerns or comments about this afterwards as we go along? And I guess part of this is something that I have found problematic throughout all the conversations, along with John's quality issues, which I don't feel are problematic. I think we do need to include them. But the alignment pieces isn't really our purview, but how do we address that chasm between higher ed and the public school system, which again I would say pre-K through grade 12, not K through grade 12. So I don't know where we put this. Is this just something we have to think about in order for this report to make progress, or is this... And the other piece that I can't quite get my hands around, I understand the concept of degrees and certificates of value leading to higher wage earners. Coming from the field of early childhood, which is among the lowest wage earners, but something of value, in order to keep these employees working and to make sure that the next generation doesn't fall into this, are we totally disregarding work that doesn't bring in higher incomes as something of no value? Right, but I don't.
The pathway to further education, so the value is so that there will be some progression in the
process. Understand that, but then you also talk about high priority degrees and how this is really an emphasis on high priority degrees and high priority as defined by business.
Can you explain what's the connect, the correlation between that and affordability? I mean, I understand if you're going to a reasonably affordable school in Connecticut, that's fine, but there are some expensive schools in Connecticut, too.
Question. You said narrow the gap between cost of attendance and family income. I'm trying to figure out what that means, other than having some kind of tuition differential if you're the lowest income, or does it mean you'll have financial aid based on family income? I mean, how do you implement something like this? Need based at the state level, or okay. So if tuition goes up, it's reasonable then to expect that state based financial aid will increase to make it possible to meet this metric.
It's also the Dennis issue of, I mean, state appropriations are part of the equation too. In other words, if in this particular state they basically cut out a third of the funding of public higher education and then capped tuition at the same time and provided no additional funding for student aid, and we're wondering whether it would. And then wanted to know whether that was going to affect the university system. And we basically answered that to the legislator that you would not have a university system. It would disappear over time. So you've got to put at least those three things on the table and say, is that leading to an affordable?
Thank you.
Could I make a comment on that? I actually think it would be helpful in talking about this, that first bullet, which is really quite a mouthful and a very important bullet about an affordability target, to maybe disaggregate. I mean, there are, I don't know, I can think of three parts here or four. I mean, obviously the how much the tuition costs, controlling tuition growth, is at one level, but underlying what the tuition is are what are the costs of operating the institutions of higher ed, and we should work to control those costs because that's ultimately the way to make college more affordable. and also to work to address the amount of public subsidy that's going into the university system. Those are both separate and I think worth identifying as, you know, those are the, maybe there's a third approach of generating alternative sources of revenue for higher education potentially. And I mean, there are some good examples there as well, but to really lay out sort of what these different tracks are so that people can keep them in mind.
No, and in fact, Ben, that's exactly what we discussed with this legislator last night. That in fact she was, I think, willing to go with a, you know, reasonable tuition increase, provided there was a measure included in there that would lead to improvement of the number of degrees produced for the money that you've got. You know, the some value proposition mixed into it, which was really leading to more efficient getting people through to a degree. So, yeah, so I...
certainly doesn't address the major problem, but I think that some mention along the way of the impact, the financial impact of having middle college and having students basically in public school and publicly funded getting their first year possible at no cost may become a big factor in that.
Dennis, this is a problem with the accreditation agencies. You cannot make a general statement about the number of credits. You have to look at individual fields and colleges and so on before you make a statement on, okay?
We're trying to do early college so the students graduate from high school with an associate degree, and it varies in a certain number of areas. But there's a cost to it because, again, we have to pay our faculty at the community college to teach those courses. Again, by accreditation standards, they have to be our faculty. So that's part of the challenge of not being funded to approach that, to do that.
Well, we have the, at UConn, we have the early college experience, ECE. And that actually is in 167 high schools across the state, and almost 100,000 students in Connecticut participate. Many of the students who come to UConn carry in an entire semester. But I do want to say we're not just urging them to graduate early with that. We're also urging them to pursue majors that require additional credits and are much more stringent, much more challenging. So. I think we have to be flexible about, again, mission, different types of students coming in. But we, you know, I can send you the data on early college experience, which is very, very broadly used across the state and saves a lot of students. In fact, it's accepted by the Board of Regents too, UConn ECE credits and a few of the programs that they use. So it's not just UConn students that benefit from this.
no expert, but it's my experience with the profile at community colleges, at least, even though the profile has gotten younger as four-year schools have become more expensive. I dare say at least half family income isn't even on the table. These are students working full-time, going to school, and so a median family income has no bearing.
Can I just remind people to use the microphones if they can so everybody can hear, and we do make a recording of these as well for those that can't attend the meeting. Thank you.
Got discipline. So, Dennis, is there any way also to document how many students are engaged in some kind of work experience, internship, everything like that, when they're involved in there? Well, that, I thought you did say yes. Except that's something that you could, the institutions could contribute. Because that has a lot to do with whether they stick.
I just figured out what's making me so uncomfortable about certificates. And that is, somehow, I would love to see if we could define those students graduating with some nationally recognized credential rather than just some certificate.
Dennis, is it possible to get data, a finer grained resolution of that age from 25 to 64? I mean, it's 40 years lumped together, and I don't know what's going on, let's say, when folks are 30-year-old, 40-year-old, et cetera. Is there a finer grained resolution? Something like that, because conditions change over a period of 40 years. You can't lump them all together, really.
I have to raise a concern that I have. I serve on the State Board of Education, and we recently had a document on the state of education K through 12. And the data shows that 47% of the students K through 12 are students of color. When we talk about increasing certificates, what I don't want, and I hope this report can somehow express it, is that those students of color that are usually in the districts that where there's an achievement gap, that they are directed to the certificate level, that they are not given the opportunity, the equity. Equity should be at all levels for all students with a proportion that it's fair and appropriate. So we're not tracking students of color only to a certain level in terms of education attainment.
About if you're going to increase the number of adults, you
also, Stella, and you know more about this, it's making sure that the existing certificates have built in with them clear pathways to credit-bearing courses,
sure,
which is not necessarily the case right now. So they may be starting there, but they should not be stopping there.
Another question, would it not be helpful also to know the percentage of students who enter the university system who have some credits from the community colleges, just so we'll know what kind of flow exists? That would be helpful. Thank you.
Also have Pell eligibility as a proxy for low income, so that we can look at the success rates of those that are Pell eligible versus those that are not. But it's too soon to report on the gateway success, because if last fall they're just confronting their remediation, we need some time before that becomes an outcome that we can report on.
Exactly. So our new, what we can report or what we need to report is based on the changes that have taken place. So,
thank you.
on our website. It's on OIRE website. I don't think we have it by age, but we can get it. Check right now. Just another figure that would be useful, just because a certificate is awarded doesn't mean that that is education interrupted. It just means along the way. Can we get some, and I don't even know if this is possible, some sort of measure of those students of that number who got certificates as just a part of the journey, or those who got them as the goal? A lot of them do it in parallel, so that's not so useful.
Are who they are. I just, there is a bill for the legislature which would gather much more information on the nature of certificates currently being offered, who they are, by to whom, that kind of thing. Dennis, going back to the adult one, that there isn't this a state where you need to do much better on the associate degree level participation, even though it's 50-50, the numbers are not bigger, so that getting more adults into the associate degree and through to associate degree is a major gap compared to other states. Dennis, those would be certificates as reported in IPEDS. Yeah, right.
I think that figure with our manufacturing centers now at the community colleges in multiple locations, you will see that there are a lot more credentialed. Yeah. This may be a little late to comment on the strategy, but I don't believe that keeping young people in state to go to school is as good an answer as providing internships during the summer that engage them in state companies. So that's just a footnote. Thank you.
Dennis? The issue of quality is, of course, a national issue. It's not just here. But in Connecticut, we had the regional meetings, as you remember, last year about this time, and met with employers, some of us on the commission, as well as you and Ames. And I think the employers kind of gave you an idea of what they consider quality education. It's in terms of their needs. They're looking for some cultural things, being on time for work. They're looking for good communications, the ability to deal with logic and computers and so on. We had some very definitive statements for employers. And I think we should go back. In the memo I sent yesterday, actually, I do enumerate some of those statements we got from employers, and I think it provides a certain guide. For our purposes, those answers provide a certain guide. It's a national issue. There's no question about it, and no two answers are the same. But in our case, we have some answers. We had the beginnings of answering that question, thanks to those regional meetings. It was a good idea.
Yes, could we back up for just a second? I'm an old-fashioned Keynesian believer in government intervention to deal with major problems. I'm very worried about the kinds of reports we see in Robert Putnam's book and Quillen's zombie economics and all the rest of it. The studies seem to show that we're going backwards, actually, in a lot of ways, and that the gaps between the rich and poor, children coming from families, is getting bigger, that real educational achievement goes to mediocre people who have the money to buy their way into various institutions to buy special educational programs and so forth, which seems to be, makes sense in the environment we're in. Shouldn't the first metric in all of this be state aid per capita to education at every level that we're talking about? Baccalaureate granting degrees, those universities that offer advanced degrees, associate degrees, and so forth. It seems to me everything we've talked about is dependent on all of us lobbying, or however we want to do it, somehow enticing people in power to fund education properly. And to look at the long-range ramifications of inequality, the gaps growing all the time, and what the likely outcome is. We're dealing with 2025 here as, of course, a sensible period of time in which to work. But if the reports of many people, studies of many people are right, by the time we get to that point, you're going to have to own, a Mercedes and a raccoon coat in order to go to college. And, we're looking at even at the University of Connecticut today, the price of tuition and living there and various other fees is such that it taxes normal families. And income has not grown anywhere near the proportion of increase in higher education. So I would just like to say, and again, it may not belong in this study, but I think it does. I've been an active Democrat in Connecticut all my life. I'm interested in that issue, state aid to education. And when I see it dropping in the years that I taught from 75% down to about 45% or even less, I'm worried about that. And I think that would be one way we could also gauge, you know, progress we're making or not making. If aid continues to fall, I don't think many of these programs are going to be viable. We just won't have the options to even engage in them. Just one final point along with that. Before we begin with these very sophisticated metrics, and they're excellent, and I can see the value of every one of them, but one of the basic points I'd like to see is, for example, more courses offered each semester as a beginning by all the institutions, more students brought into the system in some way, enhancing programs in the summer when universities sit there basically empty, and they could be used, you know, to give people a head start in the colleges, in their college career. Couldn't we have some simple measure of immediate, of sort of an immediate takeoff or an initial development that would lead into these other things? I spent my whole life, 38 years, watching lost opportunities develop at CSU, where things could have been done. Buildings could have been purchased, programs could have been created. It was always, no, they couldn't do it for one reason or another. I think where the rubber hits the road is simply the number of courses you offer, the size of your program on a three-semester basis, and also the number of students that you attract.
You know, I think Dennis's point, you didn't go back to the other one, on the student learning one. We've had NCHEMS, for various sundry reasons, was deeply involved in the whole issue of assessment of student learning. Estella knows about that. And one of the lessons from that is that it's very hard to have external assessment have an impact on internal improvement. In fact, there's almost an inverse relationship between external assessment and motivation of faculty to actually use the results of that for internal improvement. And so we're not suggesting, you know, a relatively simplistic new way to measure learning at a state level. But on the end of the day, you know, listening to John Bennett and others, we do need to have some evidence about this. And we do need your help. I mean, Dennis was not just making that as a paper. And I think one of the criteria is you really need to do this in a way in which will be useful to faculty members and others really engaged and really sincere. And the more it's done by people outside instead of done two things, it's in fact it creates antibodies that in fact it will not be used. So that's a real dilemma, and so we really are serious about needing ideas from you about what would be good indicators that actually have a constructive impact internally. I just maybe one other point. How many of you have read the OECD reports on skills of the adult population? If there's a new assessment called PIAC, which is a program for assessment of adult literacy. And the United States performs in a really mediocre way compared to other nations. And it's basically an assessment of the skills that we've just been talking about. The U.S. population simply is falling way behind others in the kind of employability. It's both knowledge and skills that have. And the United States actually participates in that assessment. And one of the things Connecticut could, in fact, consider doing is increasing the sample size of that for Connecticut to be able to get a good assessment of the knowledge and skills of the adult population. that would be a good indicator of whether, in fact, something is happening. But that's just a thought.
All the institutions I'm familiar with, and I know several in Connecticut and other states, this conversation is going on all the time. It's not easy to come to a conclusion. We all talk about assessment, periodic assessment, accreditation, and so on. It's not true that these conversations don't take place. And we really have to, if this commission is going to do anything, we've got to come up with some radical new ideas, strategies, and so on. Things that are not on familiar ground, familiar to the institution and their faculty and their administrators. A lot of this discussion is going on all the time. I want you to know. There's nothing new of what we say here that's not being discussed on every campus I know of. So what is truly radical, new, and so on that we can propose? And I must say, I did send email with two proposals to the commission, but I don't think I got any response to that. On the issue of revenue stream, we should consider the endowment, a public-private collaborative scheme, endowment for higher education, that will produce a steady base of income to support higher education from associates up. And as far as degree attainment is concerned, we've got to pay attention to why people don't go to college. It's not that Connecticut is so bad. It is, as far as the gap between minorities and the white population is concerned. But, you know, the question is, how can, and we maybe understand why. The point is, how can we fix it? We're looking about strategies to implement. And the discussion of what's quality education, et cetera, that goes on all the time. Let's think about strategies.
Quick point following up on that. One of the areas we may want to look at in the coming years, over the last couple of years, the governor has championed a very successful Go Back to Get Ahead program in Connecticut Public Higher Education. And I imagine, you know, it's still new enough that there's not enough data. But, I mean, I imagine that is a population group that would be ripe for studying maybe a year or two from now to see of those who applied, of those adults who wanted to go back to get ahead, how many of them succeeded, how many of them are at a certain point throughout their thing. So when we talk about adult learners, I mean, I think that's it's a terrific program. I think it's... Well, I mean, that's... That is the ultimate goal of the program.
You talked about, and this is the number of baccalaureate degrees
My IR person wrote to me today an 86% in the increase on STEM bachelor's degrees from 2003. And to me, this is also connected, I have to say it, to the investment the state made during these years, where we could direct our students, our programs, to meet workforce needs in the area of STEM. So this is, to me, an example of what happens when you have the financing and the will and the intentionality to increase your degrees in to meet the state's needs.
Dennis, why should that be only, with all due respect to UConn? I mean, there are other contributions of the other independent institutions to business activity. I mean, if you...
an independent report that report done last year, and we also have increased our engineering degrees, I think, you know, by fourfold in the last 20 years, more than that.
But if you, I mean, the whole reason for having the second objective was to say that engagement of all the institutions in a region of the future of New Haven or the major areas really had to involve and recognize the contributions, whether it's Yale or whatever it may be, to the building an economy that actually leads to something. And that it would be a good idea to be able to really document that more. It was due to your help that I have a good deal of that information.
Another one that's in the report, and we talk about partnerships.
Report, but I don't think we're collecting it now as a system. So it is done by campus, so we may be able to have some of that.
Having just reviewed a lot of scholarship applications in which that's a question, I can tell you that the students' definitions of community service are very broad-ranged, and I think that they probably won't be very useful.
Are we looking for, I guess kind of to that point, a quality, like a number of hours, or just a percentage of students who participate in community service?
Thank you.
So you're looking more for community engagement than community service, which goes, I mean, jumping way back before we said we want to increase the percentage of students who go to college in Connecticut. I think this is all leading to our true goal is not to increase the percentage. I mean, we want to increase the percentage, but it's more important to increase the percentage of students who stay in Connecticut after they go to college. So that's the service. Now, with the partnerships for the metrics, have we at all described what those partnerships would look like? Are we looking at, I mean, because that will help with, obviously, with developing the metrics.
This is also throw it to Mikey, but I think this, you know, the interesting thing about this is really a means to an end, which you're just describing. In other words, why is this in there? And the whole reason was that for the whole idea that a lot of the future Connecticut depends upon creating communities where people want to live and function, and one of the ways you do that is in fact through partnerships between higher ed and the institutions and the communities they're dealing with. And that can be for internships. It can be for a whole variety of different reasons. Is that?
No, that's exactly kind of what I envision is that almost the college is opening up in some form of, whether it's a makerspace, getting students engaged with the smaller businesses. And in that way, it could be a measurement is how many businesses served, whether it's having marketing drop-in hours where small business could come in and marketing students could work on projects with them, or
right.
Engineering students could be working with, you know, using the maker spaces, 3D printing, whatever it is, to help with the small businesses and improving their processes and giving them ideas.
Yeah, I mean, my fixation about this, to go back to Dennis's thing, was really related to sustainable communities, that you've got a real problem of places that are really, people are not going to be able to live because of costs, the cost of food, the cost of a whole set of other things. And those are things that students are really interested in. It's part of their curriculum to talk about issues related to the future environment and sustainability. And one way to do that is, in fact, for them to be engaged in working on community solutions. And it has a major payoff both ways. And that, those things are going on at virtually every university or college in Connecticut. So one worry I have is this will just, you can view this as essentially let's list a set of PR things for all the wonderful things higher ed is doing. My concern is just the reverse. Can you document what you're doing and identify the barriers to doing more and measure that, in fact, we ought to be doing more? And what gets in the way in terms of policy and internal and external that these things are not happening more? And they relate a lot to do with internal academic policy, reward systems for faculty, support ways. And you don't do internships and integration of community service with curriculum simply by saying go do it. It takes faculty time to do it, and we're not interested in indicators of just list all the wonderful things we're doing and they're going to praise it. So we want to measure what makes it, identify some things that we really need to improve.
James, I think the word partnership, perhaps I had the same question, by the way. It's not the correct way. What you describe here is really outreach. It's the outreach the universities extend to the towns they live in. I mean, a great partnership. I know Trinity College several years ago, they established a good partnership with or outreach with the community in the neighborhood of Trinity College. But this is basically outreach, and you're right, it takes professors' time, etc. There might be another partnership, the kind of thing that MIT has with Boston, where we have intellectual property transfer, for example, and then that is in the financial area, not just outreach, as we discuss it here. So maybe that word can be modified.
Thank you.
That's entirely because our income is higher than the national average, I'm afraid to say.
It's really worthwhile to look at this institution by institution and to realize that at the institutions that are serving more low-income students, the public four-year institutions, this figure is really high. The second group that tends to be high are independent institutions that don't have large endowments to be able to provide accessible, you know, student aid. So places like Yale and, you know, Wesley and I know Yale in particular, the average student graduating with debt is about $14,000. In other words, it's one-half what it is at the public institutions. So the resources that institutions have for this, and so you have a number of independents in this state, independent institutions that really serve Connecticut students that are very high levels. I'm talking about $35,000, $40,000, $50,000 average debt. And if you look at New England generally, you'll see a set of small independents that frankly are really at risk in the process. So it's the averages are deceiving, and so I think the ones that are really show up are really the publics, the four-year institutions serving large numbers of Connecticut students, and a series of independents that frankly serve local students. These are not globally, you know, these are serving Connecticut students are also at risk.
Could I ask a question about the since you ended on these affordability metrics? It seems to me that, and I appreciate Ames's comment about looking at individual institutions, because I find the aggregate data is somewhat frustrating, because it doesn't really help me. I mean, yeah, I'd like the numbers to be lower or higher depending on how they go. I'd like to do better overall, but I really do think that the affordability challenges are really very diverse amongst the different, not only segments, different types of institutions, different types of populations who are interested in attending school, different types of programs. So, for instance, you know, the question of how affordable are certificate programs in private institutions, and it seems as though private institutions are providing most of our certificate programs. I have no idea. I suspect, maybe rightly or wrongly, that maybe those are not as affordable as the comparable programs in public institutions, and that there you may be able to make a lot of traction on affordability by expanding certificate programs in public institutions, for instance, and that won't move those aggregate numbers very much at all, because those are all pretty low-cost programs, and they're going to be dwarfed by the $70,000 tuitions at some private institutions, and you know, middle and upper middle class families borrowing, you know, $100,000 to send their kids to school, and maybe that's a problem. I, you know, speaking as a parent of a bunch of college-age kids, I'd love you to figure out a way to reduce those costs. But on the other hand, solving my affordability problem is clearly less of an issue for this group than solving the affordability problems that are keeping us from getting more, you know, getting to that 70% number.
Right.
I mean, if for the families of well-educated middle-class folks who feel the affordability issue very keenly, it's not like the cost of this is keeping us from educating our children. It's maybe directing them to different institutions. It's saddling us with debt. It's forcing us to postpone paving the driveway or what have you. But ultimately, it's not going to have a huge impact on whether or not we get to our numbers. But there are other areas where I think affordability really probably is going to have a greater impact on how many kids are getting, or adults are getting, the degrees and getting degrees that are helpful to them in their lives. So I'm wondering whether how much we are able to identify affordability by socioeconomic status, by race, by degree program, by institution, by circumstances of various kinds, because I think that those may allow us to be more targeted in how we direct public resources to keep college more affordable and how we direct other types of aid. Or
the other thing, which is in some cases you can use public money to leverage private money to deal with some of these areas. In other words, that I don't make this argument in one way or the other, but to the extent that private institutions, for example, put their own resources behind affordability, a little bit of public money can go a long way to assure some of those students are served. So it's also leveraging private resources to help things that, in fact, if you had to build a whole public capacity to continue to subsidize, it's almost easier to purchase from that. I mean, I just mentioned.
Ben, I want to reinforce, I mean, the data are pretty clear that for folks in middle to upper income families, the affordability issue affects choice of institution, but not whether or not they go. I mean, they will, you know, change the type of institution that they otherwise would have attended, but they will go. The low-income students' affordability affects whether they go at all. It's not where they go; it's whether they go at all. And so, you know, you're right. And we will see how far we can push this by subpopulation, because you're absolutely right. The difficulty is that particularly the for-profit institutions, there are no data from them except default rates that say how affordable or not affordable are institutions, but they don't have the same reporting requirements that Title IV institutions have, or that community colleges and four-year public and private independents have. So it's just nigh onto impossible nationally to get data about economic status of students. We know what the income characteristics of Pell Grant recipients are, but if you never apply for a Pell Grant, you have no idea what we're dealing with as far as income of students. So, you know, it's one of the places where data just bedevils us now, you know, and it might be an area where there are Connecticut data that we can work with that are better than national data. I'm sure there are, and so
I would think that's true. And the other factor, particularly if we're looking at our urban areas, after all, our overarching goal is to have a highly skilled, competitive workforce where the median age is a lot lower than it is currently. And I would posit that Connecticut has statistics that are different because of a huge number of undocumented students who aren't eligible for Pell.
Among the 25-plus students, current or graduates, I think a large number are probably non-traditional students. I know that for a fact. They are, which means they take their coursework at night and so on while they're having or they're doing full-time work and have families and whatnot. In most instances, the employer will reimburse the student for tuition. So is it possible to begin with to get data on how many of those students are non-traditional, the 25-plus? Is that something that we can look into precisely because of the way they finance their studies? Okay. It's not entirely true, but a large percent. I agree with you. The financing coursework or college work is a little different than the below the 25, those who are full-time, et cetera. And as I said, there is a reimbursement for employers. And there is, it appears, a ready-made partnership as far as the education of that cohort that we might like to explore and introduce into our thinking and so on.
One of the realities of tuition assistance programs, and as we've experienced it around the country, two points. One, the proportion of employees that take advantage of them is abysmally small, for whatever reason. But the numbers are very small. And the second is that there is a cash flow problem associated with tuition assistance programs, because education institutions require that students pony up the money up front. Employers pay employer or the employee only after they've completed the course successfully. So if they don't complete it at all, or if they complete successfully, it's still 5 months or 6 months later before the employer reimburses the student for their out-of-pocket costs. And so there are a set of institutions that have learned that if they put these employees that have such programs on a monthly payment plan rather than pay everything up front, I mean, there are ways to, you know, get around that roadblock, but these students that are independent, they don't have family help, they're working their way through, that tuition bill may be more than they can stand all at once, and so it's discouraging and they don't do it at all.
You're absolutely right. I had to deal with this problem repeatedly with our non-traditional students, you know, having fights with the university controller all the time. But it's something we can do something about it to the extent that we advertise for the difficulties are. But you're quite right. The mechanics are not quite right. Yeah. In doing that.
Well, it certainly represents another revenue stream that we don't take nearly enough advantage of. Let's put it that way. I guess the question for you folks, I hope Ames took good notes, and I hope I remember much of it. I think we got some ideas about where we need to add and put depth and nuance to some of this. But I guess the question before you is that we'd like to just listen to you. For those for which, you know, like partnerships, like community engagement, like quality, I mean, those for which we have no really good metrics, you know, how do we go about closing some of those gaps? I mean, what's a process that would be helpful?
You know, I just wanted to go back to the area where we were talking about communication. And I do think that we've got a lot of metrics here, but we're not really talking about, we're talking about affordability. We're not talking about accessibility. And I wonder if there isn't a little bit more information that we could have about the ability to communicate, to assess things critically, to really have the drive that our mainstream families do.
to actually overcome these barriers. And I have to believe that, especially in a state like Connecticut, where we live in isolated societies that are quite disparate, that some way of assessing connectivity has to be part of how we succeed here. And whether that's physical connectivity or connectivity through partnerships and workplace learning should make some kind of a difference. But it would be interesting to find a way to advance critical observation and communication skills beyond workforce skills.
You know, as Mary was speaking, I was thinking about where Judith had originally started, right? And talking about K-12 education or pre-K-12 education, and you had said that we are not really responsible for that. But in terms of accessibility, how do we not think about that, and how do we not incorporate that? Because when we talk about partnerships, I think about that. I think about pre-K-12. And I don't just think about, in terms of how do you start developing those soft skills early, I think that's where you start.
It's really about a shift of culture and sustaining that change in culture and becoming more of a community statewide as opposed to isolated disparate communities.
I would suggest defining partnerships in terms of some expected outcomes, because otherwise you're going to get description. You're going to get, you know, I partner with 200 people, but, you know, what are the outcomes? Do we get internships? Do we get support in terms of funding? Do we get, exchanges? I would look, at the national level, some of those better definitions that may be able to illustrate us of how to do a better job of reporting on that area. I think we have a lot of partnerships. I think we work locally. I know the community colleges do, the universities do also with the local communities at all levels, with the school systems, you know, in terms of the teacher education programs that they do, the teaching studies at the high schools and all that. So we do have a lot of those. But again, it's how are they meaningful relationships that help in the long run to produce, as you said, a quality education, a professional that is well prepared.
Isn't a lot of this at the heart of what you must have within your institutions about what the quality of undergraduate education is? Out of curiosity, how many institutions, and I'm sure it's a high number, so I'm not actually use the survey of student engagement, NESE, actually to assess whether, in fact, students are engaged.
We do.
I mean, one of the...
Do.
Is that generally done? I mean, how about...
Yeah, we do.
I mean, that's one indicator of whether, in fact, your students feel engaged in various...
We've used it over the years to increase our retention, you know, and primarily identify, because we have so many different retention programs, what seems to make the biggest difference.
But as far as I know, the community colleges have continued to do this, even though I'm, you know, not employed at one currently, but it was commonly done.
Yeah.
The real issue is also whether it's used.
How you use the data that makes it
the kind of...
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me be the arbiter, and David, finish your thought, and then let's go forward.
The kind of data that you're looking for is readily available at the department levels. I know at CSU, I chaired a committee on internships for 2 years, and practically every program that had an outside accrediting agency had to report various programs, of the practicums and programs of the type you're talking about.
Right.
And we also were required, our department was required to keep individual files on students who had taken internships to see whether or not they were really roadways to employment after graduation and so forth. So if it were possible to collate that, you know, at the university level, the departments could give you pretty good data on what you're looking for.
Sally, did you want to tip, you know?
Just the word on internships. We've talked about non-traditional students and how non-traditional may be more traditional. And if we're looking at low-income students and we're talking about non-paid internships, that can produce a burden for that student who is working his or her way through college. Now, for students who receive some academic credit or as part of a course that they're taking, that's a different kind of a situation. I just think we need to be aware of that so that we're not saying we want to see more unpaid internships for or no academic credit for low-income people who are working their way through college.
Actually, now law, I believe, about internships that requires students at the collegiate level that are doing an internship either to receive college credit or remuneration. So the idea of free labor is a thing of the past. So that's a good thing for all students, I think. I want to bring us back also, if there are no other, you know, burning questions, to Dennis asked a very important question of us, which is, so we have some real gaps in terms of some of those metrics that we need to identify, and part of that is developing definitions, whether it be partnerships or whatever. I think what we need to know is how should we go about doing that, and what part do you want to play in it? Part of Dennis and Ames' job is to help collect research and data, but some of this we have to do ourselves. So, Dennis, did I hear you correctly?
That's exactly it. I mean, some of these will be filled individually, you know, like the data on developmental ed can be done by CSCU, but there are issues that cut across that it would really be helpful to have, you know, members of the task force or the commission work on those things so that we actually have contributions from you all the next time rather than our just lecturing you. That was the essence of it. Now, we may not resolve that now, but maybe there's a way, I'm saying this sort of out loud, where you have an expressed interest and we could facilitate connecting two or three of you together. Is that a way to do it, rather than you're taking time now? You know the areas, and if you could express an interest or request, would you be interested in working with, you know, two or three other members of the commission on a further refinement of this particular area? Is that a way to, and then we can kind of put you together.
Is it possible for you to send an email identifying the areas you would like information?
Yeah,
could you do that so we can do this in a more systematic way?
Yes,
yeah. I think it would also be helpful to have a sense of to what end.
Yeah.
I certainly don't mind providing the data, but I mean, I think my guess is, given what the goals are, you've got a lot of what you need. We'll spend a lot of time defining partnerships, a lot of time defining economic development and various projects happening, but I'm not so sure that's central to the mission of what we're trying to achieve here.
Wouldn't the end, Sally, be actually a report that has really indicators that, first of all, reflect the plan, but I think the second one is one that you all have some ownership in. They're not just sort of imposed on.
But again, to my question just is to what end? So are you looking for partnerships that seem to increase retention or graduation?
Oh,
then,
yes,
then
that's
you,
a really good point.
You've
that's
got.
Point.
Otherwise, we're just, you know, I can send you hundreds of reports.
So so maybe to respond to that, if Dennis and I take on the assignment of doing a better definition of the gaps, mm-hmm. and one of the comments we've had is that the word partnership is not helpful. Okay.
The research about retention is pretty clear on what makes a difference. So, you know, if it's really about how students get meaningful relationships, then that's one thing. If it's about what work experiences lead them to degrees, that's another thing. And, you know, we all write hundreds of these reports. We all collect, distribute hundreds of these reports. The legislature asks us for, you know, hundreds of these reports, and we try to do that. But the real question is, again, to what end? Are you if you're what you're really trying to, if we're really trying to increase the number of degrees and certificates and in areas of critical need for Connecticut's economy, let's talk about internships in those areas. I think we, you know, I just like to, we all have so little time, especially this time of year. I just like to be clear on what we can get and how easily we can get it.
Yeah, I think we understand that.
Can I just ask a question? Does it make some sense for us to also be soliciting some of the business sector as we had for input earlier in this process about successful paid for credit practicum-oriented programs that have generated result? I mean, does all the data come from the education institutions, or should we assess outcomes that are already in place in the community?
I'll tell you what, just because we're limited on time, why don't Dennis and I take on the assignment of defining four or five areas that we feel will be, again, productive use of time, Sally, and we can get some feedback whether we're right and whether you're really interested in those, and then put together something that will be useful activities between. So just as one commercial about this, I think that engaging people and trying to work to address the issue about work experience internships will have a positive effect of increasing the statewide discussion about how that's so important. I mean, that's one of the effects of this commission, of simply raising the conversation about why those are important and how do you define them and how they're useful or not useful. And so is that okay, Dennis, if we... And then the next question will be doing what you suggested, sending that out, and then maybe doing some matching of you all to get some work done.
Madam Chairman, beyond this, what we're discussing now, is there anyone in the government, the state government, that is breathlessly waiting for our report? And if so, when?
We do have some time parameters.
All of us.
I didn't want to put you on the spot, but it's true. The governor's office is very interested in all of his agencies in what this group is doing. Do we have an actual deadline? I think we do not have a deadline. We have the imperative to do a good report, but it's not forever. I mean, we're looking at the next couple of months of trying to put these measures and outcomes together.
But, you know, also to your question, Vagos, I think that, you know, I indicated that on the question of certificates, the commission has had impact. I think that there are two other areas that the commission has impact. First of all, there are two bills working their way through the legislature. The first one basically cleans up a lot of prior legislation, but the nub of it is that the goals as established by the Planning Commission are now the ones that are put in the statute, and it's going to say that in all of the places where there were goal statements, the goal statements will be the ones that you folks have put together. Okay, so there's commonality across at the state level. You know, the universities, you know, UConn, CSCU will all have their own goals, but within the context of a single set that applies and is in statute. So that's one. And the second is one that essentially creates a task force to start the process of implementing the recommendations that are in the report about how do you finance higher education in the state. So the whole question of and it's around all of the things that Ben mentioned. It's state appropriations, it's tuition, it is student financial aid. It's where does the money come from? How does Connecticut kind of afford attaining the goals it set for itself? But it's a direct consequence of what you folks have done. Is that responsive to your question?
I would echo the sentiment that it intended to do as well, too. I don't think we would have had that those two pieces of very key legislation move forward had there not been interest in the work that we're doing. And I think the time is absolutely right. There is sometimes a little bit necessity becomes the mother of invention. You know, we're at a point now where resources are precious. And this is one area we can begin to look at how we use our resources and to what end. And you've been very, very helpful in making sure that discussion's focused in the right way. So the commission should be very proud of the work that it's done. And I think it's got some traction now. So go ahead. Did you want to say something?
So we will do our assignment, and I think this is probably the major task between now and September, if we can help organize it that way. Is that right, Dennis? Mm-hmm. So it depends on us getting back to you with that list of areas and the kind of survey that
I mean, we will be doing some things in the meantime. One of the lines of work that we volunteered for this calendar year is what we've called the policy audit, the thing that says, here are the goals, what's in the way in state policy, state regulation, and et cetera, of pursuing those effectively and efficiently. Those are the kinds of things where we sit down with campus people and say, tell us your problems with trying to get certain things done, and what is there about the way Connecticut does business or higher education does business in the state that's in the way of doing this more effectively, more efficiently. So that is one of the tasks. So we will likely show up on at least some of your campuses to have those conversations. But, you know, that's our assignment. We'll try to figure out some assignments for you in that same time period, okay? And if there are occasions when we need to get together, not with everybody, but with subgroups working on something, we'll try to make this work with our trips to do our piece of it. Is that a way to think about how we get from here to September?
I'd just like to add a cautionary tale. The early childhood field developed an early childhood teacher credential a number of years ago, and there's a state law that says that a certain percentage of the workforce has to have a bachelor's degree and a certain percentage has to have an associate's degree. This credential was a way to do it. It was certainly attached to a four-year and a two-year degree. On the other hand, there's legislation now to remove the early childhood teacher credential, which many feel is a credential of value. And also to grandfather in many people until 2025 and to move out the date that the requirements for degrees and to grandfather this 25 to 64-year-old population because they don't want to get the degree. They don't feel they need the degree. And here we're looking at moving toward a skilled workforce in almost every field that we have. So I'm just putting this forward because we're doing a lot of this work, and there's still resistance.
So noted, and a very good questionnaire to end on. And with that, I thank you for your patience. We're actually well overdue. Stay tuned. There will be communication going forward. For those of you that are sending things out to the whole group until Jeannie sends it out. I have a new email address, so it's judyk.resnick@gmail.com. So if you need me to see something, that would be helpful. Jeannie will eventually send it around, I'm sure. She's not in the office at the moment. So thank you again. Good discussion. Gentlemen, as always, a good job. And we will stay tuned. And good luck, Jen.
Glad you're still with us. Glad you're still here. Bill, thanks.